This is Holiday Readings and Remembrances, reflections on the season as told by members of the Northern Michigan University and surrounding communities. In this edition, we will hear from the husband and wife team of Paul and Zizi Lemberg on their individual reflections. We'll begin with Zizi Lemberg.
About a month ago, I asked my daughters, Freya and Glen Ellen, who are 15 and 9 years old, where we should put our Christmas tree this year. I was thinking that since our house had undergone some renovation and expansion, we could consider a different location for our Christmas tree. "In the same place," said Freya right away. "Almost at the same time. Don't you want it in the same place as all the other years?" asked Glen Ellen. "Ah, tradition. Sometimes children are more serious about tradition than adults are." I remember one year in China. I was born and raised there when I was probably about Glen Ellen's age, 9. On Chinese New Year's Eve, when every family gathers at home to have a feast and welcome the new year, my father decided that we would go to a Western-style restaurant to have our New Year's Eve meal. He taught us how to use a fork and knife and how to say the names of the dishes in English. I remember feeling awkward that we were the only ones in the restaurant. Though I was enchanted by the new experience of eating with a fork and knife instead of chopsticks, I also felt uncertain that we were doing the right thing. Everyone else was eating at home, shouldn't we? Everyone else was having a Chinese meal at home, shouldn't we? I thought I overheard the waitstaff talking about us. Maybe they don't have a home. Maybe they are from out of town. My worry about how we were perceived had prevented me from immersing myself in the dining experience. What a strange meal that was. Now, many Western-style meals later, this December marks my 24th year in the U.S., I can use a knife and fork just as well as I can a pair of chopsticks. And with equal gusto, I celebrate both Christmas and Chinese New Year, Thanksgiving and Moon Festival, and Easter and Buddha's Enlightenment Day. However, I always remember that special New Year's Eve meal my father introduced me to. It is all right to do things differently from what others do. My father is no longer with me. He passed away last November, but his spirit will live on. While I shall always buy yellow chrysanthemums on Chinese New Year's Eve, drink tea and eat mooncakes for Moon Festival, burn incense on Buddha's Enlightenment Day, decorate a Christmas tree after I turn in student grades, try a new pie recipe on Thanksgiving, and cook a ham in plenty of port wine and dried fruit for Easter, I will always make sure that my children know the uncertainty and pleasure that come with breaking from the norm. Happy holidays. May you be filled with the comfort of tradition and the excitement of new adventure. 节日快乐.
Perhaps it is true that April is the cruelest month, as English majors claim. Certainly it is true that December is the darkest month, for it is in December that our hemisphere slips furthest into cold and darkness. To our remote ancestors, this must have been a bleak and fearful slippage. It is a slippage that, of course, affects moderns as well, and it should come as no surprise that cold and dark December are rich with religious holidays intended to allay our darkness. I mean, of course, both inner and outer darkness. I am a professor of English at Northern Michigan University and a lifelong English major, which perhaps accounts for the allusion to T.S. Eliot in my opening sentence. More to the point, however, of this little radio essay is that I am also a Zen Buddhist priest at Lake Superior Zendo's Aurora Dharma Temple in Marquette. Our definitions of darkness, at least of inner darkness, may vary, and our cures may vary even more so. And in this season of darkness, I would like to share with you how we Zen practitioners, at least in my lineage, which is Soto Zen, allay that darkness. The central week of our liturgical year is December 1st through the 8th, a week we call Rohatsu, during which we conduct our most arduous sesshin. Sesshin means collecting the heart mind, and during Rohatsu, Zen adherents retreat, as their lives allow, to the Zendo, or meditation hall, for intensive practice of collected mind, a form of sitting meditation called Zazen. During Rohatsu Sesshin, we commemorate and in some sense reenact the central event of the Buddha's life, which was his profound awakening beneath the Bodhi tree, at first sight of, guess what, the morning star. But in order for me to make sense of Rohatsu for you, I need to back up first and offer you some preliminaries. Buddhism is one of the great world religions, older than Christianity and as many splendored in its manifestations. Buddhism manifests in a broad array of colors, from the plain austerities of Zen, which it has been said is Buddhism in black and white, to the lush and labyrinthine ritual and art of Tibetan Buddhism, which it has been said is Buddhism in technicolor. Some Buddhists pray to the Buddha and worship him as a divine being. Others regard the Buddha as a great teacher, but a teacher who is nevertheless entirely human. Zen is in this tradition. Others anticipate the Buddha of the future, and still others regard the historical Buddha not much at all. What may we say of all Buddhists? We may say of them that they trace their lineages and varied religious practices to Siddhartha Gautama, who 2,500 years ago was born a prince in what is now Nepal. Siddhartha Gautama lived a life of royal ease and privilege, and as a young man he married and had a son. But despite his life of privilege, in his 20s he was impaled by the sufferings of the world. It was then that he encountered what in Zen we call the great matter, which is the matter or conundrum of birth and death and of the suffering which attend them. How do we end our suffering? The question had struck urgently in Gautama's throat like a hot ball of iron. So caught by the conundrum was he that the prince could do nothing but abandon everything. He was not yet the Buddha, to become a wandering mendicant in search of the truth. It took years of seeking before four noble truths were revealed to the Buddha. Buddha means the awakened one, as he sat one fateful night in profound meditation under the Bodhi tree. The four truths themselves are simple, those four truths regarding suffering and the alleviation of suffering, although the ramifications of these truths are not simple. Suffering is alleviated, said the Buddha, by following the Eightfold Path, right views, right thinking, right speech, right conduct, right livelihood, right effort, right recollection, and right meditation. Here, right means in keeping with the deep structures of existence, which include the realities of impermanence and interdependence. These were the truths revealed to the Buddha, and over the centuries, different schools or sects within Buddhism have tended to concentrate on different aspects of the Eightfold Path. Zen is the school that emphasizes right meditation, called Zazen. Zazen is the root, the core, the bedrock of Zen practice, so much that we say, no Zen without Zazen. And it is Zazen that we practice in the meditation hall during Rohatsu Sesshin. Specifically, we practice a form of Zazen called Shikantaza, Japanese for just sitting. The just in that phrase, I might add, should receive emphasis, just sitting. We already know about the sitting. What we don't know about, or what we keep forgetting, is the just, and so it needs emphasis, just sitting. Zazen itself is a communal ceremony, an entirely silent one. Sitting Zazen is simply described. It has three elements, body, breath, and mind. All three are intimately linked, inextricable really, but we tease them apart unnaturally in order to explain them. First, the body. We want, we say, to sit with dignity, like a mountain. So we sit in the most stable position possible, which for the physically able is on the floor. Strange to say, chairs of any sort are unstable. We sit facing the wall in a cross-legged or kneeling position on a meditation mat and cushion. We keep the back straight, the chest lifted, the shoulders aligned with the hips, the nose aligned with the navel. The chin is tucked in just a little bit. The palms of our hands rest in our laps, one palm over the other. Our hands form an oval, our thumb tips lightly touching. The mouth is closed and the eyes are open but unfocused, and we sit as still as possible. Next, the breath. If we are sitting in the position just described, we will breathe properly from the diaphragm, much as an athlete or singer breathes. Just breathe, we say. Do what the body wants. The breath will vary like waves on the sea. Last, the mind. What about the mind, the elusive mind? We do two things. First, we are mindful of our body. Are we sitting like a mountain in the ideal posture I've just described? If not, perhaps the chin has dropped or the eyes have closed. We make whatever micro-adjustment is necessary to resume the ideal posture. And the second thing we do, we don't have a good word for this, so I'll have to give you some synonyms. We watch or follow or notice or note our breath. Now I'm breathing in, now I'm breathing out. We don't actually say these words. Now I'm just sitting here, not doing either one. The just is ever so important. We are practicing shikantaza. We are just sitting. We are not contemplating anything, much less contemplating the verities. We are not thinking. We are just sitting, observant and mindful of the moment. What happens? Thoughts come in, of course. Sometimes they burst in noisily, even violently, like chattering monkeys or rude neighborhood toughs. Other times, though, thoughts drift in lazily, silently, mysteriously, even seductively, without notice, like clouds traveling an empty sky. You know how the sky can fill with clouds without your even noticing? Ideas drift in the same way. Maybe we're planning, say, the sixth course of a seven-course meal before we even notice all the clouds in the sky. When this happens, when thoughts come noisily, silently, singly, or in streams or torrents, we simply, without evaluation or judgment, set them gently down and return to body and breath. Over and over we do this. That's all Zazen is, sitting silently like this, facing a wall, breathing like this, and when thoughts come, returning over and over to body and breath. And that's pretty much all Rohatsu is sitting like this, 1 40-minute period of Zazen after another, the periods interspersed and relieved with brief periods of walking meditation, some short chanting services, simple meals, and an hour or so of work in the afternoons. What good is Zazen, you might wonder, especially a week of it? What's the point? It sounds terribly constricting, even claustrophobic, perhaps you're thinking, sitting on a mat facing a wall, and maybe not all that interesting either. I can't even daydream, just note my body and breath. How interesting could that be? And my back and my knees, I don't even want to think about how they'd feel. Well, you'd be right about all these things. Zazen is all of these things, and more. What is the use of doing Zazen, asked Sawaki Roshi, a renowned 20th century Japanese Zen master. He was echoing a question he had often been asked. He readily supplied an answer. There is no use in doing Zazen, he said. Until this penetrates your thick skull and you are really doing Zazen that is of no use, it is really of no use. Is there a use? Well, in a way, yes. But looking for the use of Zazen is like looking for a dim star in the night sky. Because of the construction of the eye, you can't find the star by looking directly at it. If you want to see it, you have to look away from it, a bit to the side. Some things, like stars and Zazen, can be seen only indirectly. But we need not look, even sideways, for Zazen's use, since Zazen has intrinsic value, as many things do, like dancing or kissing or playing basketball or writing radio essays. Why do you dance? You don't dance to get to the end of the dance. You dance simply to dance. Sitting Zazen is a lot like dancing, or it's a lot like playing basketball in Minnesota. When I was a boy growing up in that cold, cold state, we used to play basketball in the neighbor's driveway in the dead of winter. We hardly ever kept score, and it was so cold that the ball wouldn't even bounce. The ball was as dead as the winter. But we didn't care. On that concrete driveway, our bodies visibly steamed with ardor. It was in us to play basketball, for basketball was our heart's desire. Zazen is in us, too, wanting expression, so we sit Zazen for the sake of Zazen. We sit Rohatsu for the sake of Rohatsu. Is this Zazen starting to make sense? Yes, there's the tedium and physical discomfort and even the panic. I'm going to be confined to this cushion for a week? But there's the ardor. and all that silence, all that freedom. Your only obligation is to the present moment. You have merely to attend to it, to be right here, right now, not 3 miles away or 3 days or 3 seconds away, but right here, right now. You don't even need to think about here and now or to figure them out. You can take your head off and set it down beside you on your mat for an entire week and merely be mindful of the present moment, paying it your whole and exclusive attention. It was this mindful silence, in fact, that had initially attracted me to Zen, and I can still vividly recall the first time I sat Zazen. I had gone to Tassajara, a Zen monastery deep in the mountains of Central California, to learn about Zen. On a hot June evening 20 years ago, after receiving Zazen instruction late that afternoon, I and perhaps 40 other people filed into the Zendo, and without a word from anyone, we sat silently for 40 minutes. Then, just as silently as we had sat, we filed out of the Zendo. No one had said a word. For my entire life, I had been listening to our species talk and contributing ever more to that talk myself, in classrooms, churches, living rooms, bedrooms, on front porches and backyard decks, at kitchen tables and bars, parks, tents, canoes, cars, beds, wherever we talk, and we talk everywhere. But now in this Zendo at Tassajara, at last everyone had shut up. It was astonishing. I felt as if I had participated in a minor miracle. This silent sitting was a beginning, and I now know an endless learning that points to the way of something nameless. This something nameless can be seen only indirectly, only by looking sideways. It is obscured, even hidden by language, whether spoken or written. I'm obscuring it now with all these words. But in silence, the nameless is revealed, slowly and circuitously and indirectly. This something, or more precisely, being in the presence of this something, call it Buddha nature or Buddha Dharma or simply Buddha, is steadying, clarifying, and life-giving. So if we have to have reasons, and sometimes we do, these are the reasons we sit Rohatsu. And when Rohatsu is over, what do we bring away from it? We'll be a little achy and tired for a day or so, but if we're fortunate, we'll have nothing else to show for it. Years ago, I spent part of a winter at Sonoma Mountain, another monastery, this one in the California wine country. It had been a tedious, difficult, and altogether wonderful month, all that Zazen. And on my way back to Michigan, I stopped to visit a Zen teacher of mine in Nebraska. What should I have brought back with me? I asked him. I was testing him, actually, and testing myself even more. I was pretty sure I knew the answer. My teacher looked me directly in the eye, and then he directly said, "Nothing. You should have brought back nothing." I felt relief and happiness and even a kind of freedom at his answer, for that was pretty much what I had brought back with me, except for a sack of dirty clothes. I was learning to inhabit the present moment, to wake up to it and become intimate with it, and not to grasp for the past or the future or for the myriad things we grasp for. So this is what we learn, or rather, this is what we practice over and over and over during Rohatsu, and this is how we allay the December darkness. Well, we have come to the end of Rohatsu and also to the end of this dance. I want to wish you, in this season of light, contentedness in this moment and in every moment. And besides my wish for you, I have a gatha, a Buddhist mindfulness verse for all of us. You can think of it as a prayer. This gatha is good for all weathers, all peoples, all seasons. We say it like this. May we be filled with loving kindness. May we be happy. May we be peaceful and at ease. May we be well.
Holiday Readings and Remembrances is a Public Radio 90 production produced at the WNMU-FM studios in the Learning Resources Center on the campus of Northern Michigan University. I'm your producer and host, Stan Wright. Thanks for listening, and happy holidays.